In the afterlife, divested of the flesh garment, character is apparent to all those with whom intercourse is held, and many will stand before the mirror of nature in their nakedness. In truth, our personality has always been visible to the inhabitants of the afterlife, because they too are living a material existence, and being etheric, all etheric or mental action is visible to them when they come within the zone of our thought action. The very proper desire of mankind is to enrich itself, but the difficulty is that we have yet to learn of what true riches consist. True, money is necessary during this little journey on earth, but true wealth consists of happiness, and that is found in leading a chaste, upright, just life, in doing something for others, and being true to oneself. Lives of that character grow rich indeed, and they do not have to wait until the afterlife to enjoy the wealth so gathered. Upon the other hand, the captain of finance who, with ruthless hands, has taken from others what they have earned and has accumulated a great hoard, having no lofty aspirations, goes out into the next world a pauper indeed, for his better self has not been developed, and the lines of force that have emanated from his mentality are short and dark. Those who pass out having led fairly good lives, find a condition where it is light, a condition of their own making. In the change they seldom lose consciousness, but pass into an environment where to the limit of their capacity, everything is understood, where without the loss of a day they are ready to continue to labor, to comprehend the economy of nature's law, to better understand their duties and their responsibilities, and to continue a part of the active force. Those who have led narrow and selfish lives find just the condition that they have been from day to day making, and that condition is a grossly material one. If you were to build a house without windows, how could you expect light to penetrate? The position of men in the state referred to is not one to be desired. If the world would only learn that true wealth and happiness are found in doing the best we can under all circumstances, and that wealth righteously gathered is not only enjoyed here, but is taken into the afterlife, the ambition and desire of humanity would be changed in an instant. It is a misfortune to have been wrongly educated, and especially to have been taught that money can purchase happiness, or that money is the one goal that all should seek. A spirit speaking on this general subject has said, "You all give off an aura, and if you knew the conditions emanating from some people, you would very quickly eject them from your home." In those whose lives are not strictly upright we find the aura very bad, mixed, cloudy, confused. The emanations of people of good health vary in shade from white, pale pink, to rose color. When the auras approach the dark colors, browns, grays, and blacks, we know that the person is wrong in some way. Now this aura is influenced by passions such as hate, envy, malice, evil speaking, anger, and when one sets out to do an injury to another, let me assure you that he injures himself far more than the other person. The power of thought for good or ill is demonstrated in various ways. Let a number of persons concentrate an evil thought upon another, and the effect will be found most disastrous. Again, when a band of people concentrate their thought upon one who is ill, they thereby send him vital force and strength and power. The result is restoration to health. This is the basis of the health that comes through Christian Science practice. It is all the result of concentrating the lines of force at a specified point. The result is good or bad depending upon the character of the force that is projected and concentrated at a given point. I have been told that a clean, highly developed thought goes out into the ether with the appearance of a searchlight, starting from a central point and radiating through space. Mind is matter, and thoughts are things. And so wonderfully active is the operation, that we are continually forming our mental creations in such refined substance. With all our development, and it has been great, we are able to hear only a few of the sounds that vibrate in our atmosphere. With all our achievements we are unable to see motion except it be slow in movement and in physical garment. On this subject one said, "We can also read the thoughts of another, conditions being favorable, as readily as you can gain a knowledge of the characters of symbols of a language not your own. Thoughts being motions of the mind, assume specific and definite forms, and when distinct in the mind, can be clearly perceived and understood by any spirit who is in sympathy with the mind in which they are generated. Chapter 23 Future of a Child. The Orthodox teachings make no attempt to tell us what becomes of children who go out of the earth plane in infancy. How many millions of mothers have had babies too young for speech, boys and girls just able to talk and walk, sink into a dreamless sleep, and having kissed for the last time the lips of love, have seen the little bodies lowered with tender hands into the grave, and as the earth fell upon the casket have heard from the lips of ignorance ashes to ashes, and dust to dust. With hearts without hope they have gone back to the house of sorrow, the toys, the little bed, the vacant chair, the ache in the heart, the tears that fall in countless thousands of homes, and the cries that go out in the night to know where in the vast universe the baby is, if it lives at all. What becomes of those who go out in infancy, you ask? Do they develop in mind and body? Shall we know them and meet them again? Will they know us? Is there anyone to comfort and care for them, and teach them? Do they miss and seek the mother love? These and a thousand more questions have been asked in the countless ages that have gone, and are being asked in every desolate home in the world today. Let me tell what I have learned of those conditions through many years of speech with those in the afterlife. I repeat what I have said before and shall say again, for it is the key to comprehension, that the infant at conception possesses an etheric form, at that moment clothed in a physical garment or flesh body. This etheric form is material, composed of matter, and as matter cannot be destroyed, it follows that etheric child body cannot by any possibility be annihilated. The infant etheric form by the process of dissolution passes out of the physical garment which it took on at the moment of conception, the same garment that it wore at birth, and becomes an inhabitant of the next plane of consciousness, where all is etheric, where nothing physical can enter. This change may be likened to an earth birth. There are thousands of childless women, who never in earth life found expression for the mother love. These, with countless others who find their greatest happiness in doing good together with those of blood relation, attend at such a time and take and care for the little stranger in the new environment. Let me give an instance that came under my personal investigation. It is a well-known fact that children up to about 3 years of age are able to, and do see spirit people. Some have spirit playmates. The instance I am about to relate was the passing of a little boy, only 1 week old, who had a sister a little under 3 years of age, with whom I was privileged to make an experiment. This little girl night after night saw the baby boy, and described him. He was in the same room with two spirit nurses in attendance, while another woman was from time to time described as being present. Again, this three-year-old sister often saw the spirit baby when she was away from her home. On various occasions I verified these statements by inquiry from those in the afterlife during our investigation, and found that what the little sister related had actually taken place. The woman who appeared from time to time was a grandmother. She, assisted by two nurses, cared for the little stranger, and on several occasions, before he could articulate plainly, prior to his fourth birthday, I heard him speak to me. This was a most valuable experience. Children in the afterlife are cared for very much as they are here. There are those who find their greatest delight in mothering the motherless, and teaching them words of speech and wisdom, so under such unselfish care the children reach mental and bodily maturity just the same as they would if they had remained in this world. The etheric process of development is interesting. Children need mother love no less in spirit than in earth life, and as the mother sleeps, those in charge place the etheric baby form close to her heart, where it rests absorbing the love so necessary to its existence. We little know how close the afterlife is, how close its inhabitants come to us, the influence they exert on us, or the result of our thought vibrations upon them. Then again, as the children grow, they keep in touch with us from day to day, and when we go out into the afterlife, they know and greet us as we enter the life that has no night. There are in the next life kindergartens, schools, colleges, and universities of learning just as we have here, and what is more, the inhabitants do not cease to study and increase their store of knowledge when they reach a certain age, but there are great lecture halls where the advanced ones teach the supreme laws of nature, where all are welcome and all go, and so the secrets of the universe are understood. There is but one aristocracy in the life to come, and that is founded on the refinement and development of character. Measured by this standard, how very poor are our very rich. I have often written that the aristocrats of the afterlife have gained their position by helping others less fortunate. They rise by raising others. Those alone stand erect who stoop above the lowly. Here is what a sojourner in the next plane has said of the little ones. Many people have puzzled as to the state and condition of young children in the spirit world, and it is on that subject that I desire to speak, more particularly, tonight. There are millions of young children of all ages passing into the spirit world every year. Some of them are of very tender age, while others know right from wrong. It is an interesting subject to inquire as to what they do in the spirit life. At the outset, I must tell you that there is a divine law in the spirit world, that whosoever passes into that kingdom before he has reached to man's estate upon the earth plane, shall grow mentally to the stature of man. You can gather from that the seven youngest child, even the infant which has been taken from you, will grow mentally and spiritually on the other side of life. Clairvoyants and others have often described young children in the spirit life, who have been recognized by mothers and fathers. They perhaps years after, have been somewhat astonished to hear of the child looking much older, and they have not been able to account for it. You will understand that the presentation of the spiritual form is in order that those in the flesh may be able to see them through the physical senses, and to note that they appear to be growing toward manhood and womanhood. I am afraid that many people upon your earth plane today are neglectful of their responsibilities to their children. If God has given you such a flower as a child, it is incumbent upon you by example and precept to train that child in spiritual things, so that ultimately he will be with you in the kingdom of heaven and will rejoice in the knowledge that you guided him spiritually when an infant. But how careless are many people with their children! They forget that the child is all the time taking note, not of what they are saying, but of what they are doing. I assure you that if you are unmindful of your responsibilities toward your children, you will undoubtedly have to pay the penalty when you reach the spirit side of life. Too little attention has been paid to the growing out of children. The world has little knowledge on that subject. No greater blessing can come to the fathers and mothers of every nation and tribe than to know that children with bodies too frail to carry them through the earth life are not lost in going from among us, but in the other life go right on with their growth and development under the care and guidance of good men and women who for love of humanity do the necessary work, and so enrich themselves. I am impressed not to leave this subject without a word of warning to do no murder. Know that at the moment of conception out of the mass of the universal good, out of the life mass, an etheric atom, a body infinitesimal in size and perfect in form is clothed, and no matter whether the physical birth is natural or premature, that life force so individualized has commenced its journey back to God, and all the power in all the universe cannot change its ultimate destiny. I am told that into the afterlife countless millions of children have come and are coming who have never had the advantage of a natural physical birth and earth experience so necessary to their development, but that heartless mothers by abortive acts and with the aid of dastard physicians have done and are doing countless murders, more terrible in result than the taking of the life of a man, because the unborn infant is so weak and helpless. If this knowledge shall cause any mother to spare the life of her unborn child, blood of her blood, and bone of her bone, or the physician to pause in his criminal act, sorrow untold will pass both by. Ella Wheeler Wilcox described perhaps better than she knew in her Ballade of the Unborn Dead the natural and logical result of child murder. They walked the valley of the dead, lit by a weird half-light, no sound they made, no word they said, and they were pale with fright. Then suddenly from unseen places came, loud laughter, that was like a whip of flame. They looked, and saw, beyond, above, a land where wronged souls wait those spirits called to earth by love, and driven back by hate. And each one stood in anguish, dumb and wild, as she beheld the phantom of her child. Yea, saw the soul her wish had hurled out into night and death, before it reached the mother world, or drew its natal breath. And terrified, each hid her face and fled beyond the presence of her unborn dead, and God's great angel, who provides souls for our mortal land, laughed, with the laughter that derides, at that fast-fleeing band of self-made barren women of the earth. Hell has no curse that withers like such mirth. Oh, angel, tell us who were they, that down below us fared, those shapes with faces strained and grey, and eyes that stared and stared, something there was about them, gave us fear, yet are we lonely, now they are not here. Thus spake the spectral children, thus the angel made reply, they have no part or share with us, they were but passers-by. But may we pray for them? The phantoms plead, yea, for they need your prayers, the angel said. I want to tell you, a teacher in the afterlife said, of a little waif that came to us in infancy. We taught and carefully guarded, and schooled her in the pure conditions of our sphere until she approached womanhood, but she had no contrasts, therefore she could not judge of the relative purity and delights of her environment. In order that she should be able to enjoy her home and the glories of our world, it was necessary for her to have a knowledge of earthly conditions. And so I was instructed to conduct this child back to earth from time to time. When this child first returned to earth and was among your people, she could hardly endure even to examine the gross conditions, and could not understand how people could exist in such dark, crude elements. But, as I led her along from one condition to another, over the road she would have gone had she remained on earth for the ordinary allotted period, I said to her, had you lived your time in the body, you would have been in the condition in which you see these people. I also told her that they would look gross to her when they reached the spirit state, but that in course of time they would improve enough to assume the state of purity and peace that she enjoyed. And as we journeyed on, we met one whose earthly experience had unfolded, and the little lady said, that one looks different. And I told her that this one had received a higher training. And we passed along to another place in the earth life where there were children of the poor and ignorant, as well as of the rich and learned. And we tarried until my little charge thoroughly learned the different environments of children on earth, and the great contrast between their homes, daily life, and schooling and those in spirit life. This child had never known anything but innocence and purity, and she was far removed from the ordinary conditions of the childhood of earth. It was long before she could, in any degree, recognize it as a reality. And, having learned of the methods of training in the institutions of earth, we pursued our investigations farther along, and, finally we came to where there was a great Orthodox church, and there, unseen, we mingled with the congregation. She said, this church house is not like ours at all. What is taught here? Presently the services began. I told her to listen attentively to the minister, for here she would get the average experience of the church methods and be able to see wherein a great work, in brave hands, is greatly needed on the spirit side. Then, the minister proceeded with his discourse in his regular methodical manner, telling the people all he thought essential to prepare them to enter higher realms of the spirit. But the girl, now grown to nearly womanhood, could not accept the dicta of the minister, for she had up to now been raised in the spirit world and had learned nothing that was in harmony with methods attempted by the church to enlighten the people and prepare them for future realities. Therefore the teachings of the minister seemed to her so gross, so false, so out of line with all she had ever seen, heard, or read of in the land which had always been her home that she hesitated to remain. But I told her that her future work and welfare required that she learned as much as possible of the earth conditions in which your people live, and the kind of preparation such earth conditions make for their inheritance in our life. But the more the young lady heard of the sermon, the more she disbelieved it. In fact, it was so much opposed to what she knew of the conditions on this side, and so different from what preparation while on earth for entrance to and enjoyment of spirit life should consist that at my suggestion she resolved to visit those who had just left the earth plane, schooled under its teaching, and witness the effect of it. We, therefore, journeyed on. Chapter 24 Actualities of the Afterlife. After birth, death is the greatest privilege that comes to mankind. If death did not occur, there would be old age, feebleness, poverty, pain, and suffering forever, with it, splendid life on through the ages, progress, perpetual youth and vigor. Such is the heritage of all who have lived, or who shall live in the ages to come as inhabitants of this plane. Such are the benefits coming through dissolution. Physically considered, In the final separation of the soul or spirit body from the flesh garment, there are no discomforts. As the etheric form goes out through the process called death, pain ceases, and then for a short period comes what is usually called unconsciousness. During the passing of the soul, when the individual leaves the tenement of flesh, when the spirit of man hurries forth from the old housing, there is no sensation. That period of time may be characterized as a sleep, then comes the awakening, the return of sensation, consciousness. Such is the true resurrection, and the possibility of that perfect life, unattainable to an inhabitant of earth. After leaving the earth plane, the immortal has been divested of the physical, and progress is unlimited. Again, it was my privilege to have speech with those living beyond my vision. The room in my house in which I carried on my experimental work was intensely dark. As usual, only Mrs. French and I were present. The thought, before so tense, had for a moment become passive, then from out of the silence came the deep-toned voice of him who spoke the above-quoted words. Ever alert to obtain the personal observations of those who have gone on, I said, I have been told that the afterlife is intensely real and that with you everything is just as tangible as it was when you lived among us. Tell me something of matter surrounding and composing the plane in which you live. The most learned scientist, he replied, among the inhabitants of Earth has practically no conception of the properties of matter, the substance that makes up the universe, visible and invisible. I did not when I lived among you, though I made a special study of the subject. That which you see and touch, making up the physical or tangible, having three dimensions, is the lowest or crudest expression of life force, and notwithstanding my long study of the subject, the idea that the physical had permanent etheric or life form, that which you call space was composed of matter filled with intelligent and comprehensive life in higher vibration never occurred to me. So when I became an inhabitant of the plane where I now reside, I was wholly unprepared to grasp or comprehend the material conditions of the environment in which I found myself. Tell me, I asked, of your awakening, and how things appeared to you as consciousness was restored. Of course, he replied, there was the meeting and greeting of my own who came to welcome me, as naturally as one returning after a long journey in the earth life would be welcomed. Their bodies were not so dense as when they were inhabitants of earth, but they were like my own. Then I was told that my body and the bodies of all those in that life were actually the identical bodies which we had in earth life, divested of the flesh covering. I was also told that that condition is a necessary precedent to entering the higher life, and that such bodies during earth life had continuity and, further, that in leaving the old, I had come into a plane where all was etheric, that is matter vibrating in perfect accord with my spirit or, technically speaking, etheric self. To me everything seemed perfectly natural to sense, sight, and touch. Again, let me tell you, he said, that the outer flesh garment is not sufficiently sensitive to feel, the etheric body alone has sensation. This I have said as leading up to a clear understanding of what I experienced in meeting the new conditions here. I found little body change, I had sensation and vision, and my personal appearance was in no way changed except that my body was less dense, more transparent as it were, but the outline of my form was definite, my mind clear. The appearance of age gone, and I stood a man in the fullness of my mentality, nothing lost or gained mentally. What impressed me most after the meeting with my own was the reality and tangibility of everything and everyone. All those with whom I came in contact had bodies like my own, and I recognized friends and acquaintances readily. Now I will tell you of the one thing that impressed me most on coming here, that was that matter in its intense refinement, in its higher vibration, was capable of intelligent thinking and direction. Shape and grasp this proposition if you can. I could not in the beginning, nor could I comprehend at once that all in the universe was life and nothing else. This fact, which we now know, will overturn all the propositions of science. In all the orthodox teachings of nearly 2,000 years, not one law has been given tending to show how it was possible for individual life to hold continuity. Theology has claimed it without explaining how or where. This no longer satisfies the human heart or mind, a fact which accounts for the great unrest among your people in every land. For this reason it has been our aim to explain the law through which life is continued, and so simply to state the facts and explain the conditions that all may understand. The key to comprehension is first to realize that your earth does not contain all the matter of the universe, that all that you see and touch is but the substance used by life and growth. When one leaves the earth condition, divests himself of the physical housing, he, through such change, ceases to be mortal. By becoming a resident of the new sphere he is said to take on immortality, but in reality he has always been immortal. You regard the telephone as wonderful, he said, wireless telegraphy more wonderful still, but we communicate with each other by simple thought projection. You regard the phonograph as a marvelous instrument, but it is crude beside the instruments in use among us. When you appreciate the truth that we live in a state no less material than your own, you will understand that with our greater age and experience we are much in advance of you, and make and use appliances and instruments that could hardly be explained to mortal mind. At some other time I may be permitted to discuss this subject more fully. Chapter 25 Rational Deductions. There is not in the universe a single great problem that man can truthfully say he has mastered, that nothing remains to be found out concerning it. The laws that control this world are universal and in force in other spheres as well as in this. They control all solar systems and worlds in space. Therefore, a complete comprehension of those laws and their application requires more than mortal life. If this were not so, perfection would be practically immediate and without process, and men would become gods here and now. The most brilliant men who ever lived knew but little of natural laws and of the origin and destiny of man. Until now little effort has been made to find them out. The earth is yet so crude, our senses are so dull and our vision so limited, that we fail to realize those emanations and movements of refined matter about us, or the subtle and incessant play of forces around us. From a single ray of light shoot millions of electrons and corpuscles, the basic constituents of matter, smaller than the atom of hydrogen. These, striking blow upon blow, pass by and through us in their incessant warfare with the night, but we feel them not. We do not realize the quivering and bending of the earth's crust under our feet, caused by changes of temperature or the pressure of atmospheric waves, nor do we hear the fermentations and oxidations of the soil in the changing seasons. We do not even yet know the exact nature of that ether which a recent investigator considers omnipresent and omnipotent. We see the action of gravitation, but know nothing of the medium through which it operates. We hear the wind soughing among the trees, but we do not hear the roar of sap up trunk and branch, the bursting of the buds as they bombard the air, or the speech of growing trees and flowers and grass among themselves. Yet life, wherever found, has language. The vibrations from out the abyss of space would reach our ears if they had more and higher octaves, or if our capacity for catching sound were immeasurably intensified. We do not hear the clang of the planets as they ring down through their orbits. The explosive detonations of the sun, the wild dance and chant of the nebulae, the comet's note of warning, or the rush of wandering matter of which worlds are made, which must send out impulses and tremblings through the ether to this planet of ours. We are at all times in a great sea of intensely active forces and potentialities governed by a law of which we have little conception. About us, but invisible to most, a nation, or rather many nations, of spirit people, live and move and have their being, more industrious, more active, more intellectual, and more energetic than we. So intense is their vibration that we do not ordinarily feel their touch, hear their voices, or see their forms. But conditions can be made, and have been made, whereby, notwithstanding our limitations, we may have speech with them, and know at least something of how and where they live, and what they are doing. There is so much in nature that we do not understand. Is it any wonder that, having kept our eyes so close to the ground, we have not discovered this spirit world before? We have made conditions in which it became possible for us to know a little of those other people, and, even though many have not had this evidence, that does not derogate from the truth of the discovery, which must forever stand as another fact added to the sum total of human knowledge. The possibility of communication between mortals and those in the world of spirits has been proven beyond doubt, and it now remains for men of genius to discover new methods, and to bring into this new field of research, the same intelligent action that is applied to the lower sciences, thereby increasing our knowledge of the spirit as they have of the material world. Those who, through ignorance or prejudice, decry a new discovery, and so prevent fair consideration, are enemies of civilization. The time has come for man to be free and to think alone. Neither the teachings of the so-called dead, nor the conclusions of the living, can change facts or nullify a single natural law.